Good evening and welcome to Weekly Reveille. I'm Margie Earhart.
I'm Chuck Kaufman.
And tonight we have articles from The Daily Courier and Stars and Stripes. Chuck?
I have a number of different sources. One of them is the Air Force Magazine. We also have the Washington Post and others. But I'm going to start with the Air Force Magazine with an item, USAF suicides skyrocket in 2019. This is dated February the 3rd by Brian W. Everstein. A total of 137 airmen took their own lives in 2019, a 33% increase from the 103 suicides in 2018, despite service efforts to tackle the problem. The total number may change as suspected suicides are confirmed, an Air Force spokesperson said. The high pace of suicides has long worried senior service leaders, who in July ordered wings to stand down for a day to focus on the issue. Suicide is an adversary that's killing more of our airmen than any enemy on the planet, Air Force Chief of Staff General David Goldfein said in a July letter to wing commanders. A slide detailing the tally was posted January the 31st to the popular Air Force Airman / NCO / SNCO Facebook page, which noted that a higher suicide rate within the maintenance and security forces career fields. About 10% of the airmen who died by suicide had been under investigation, according to the information. Men made up about 92% of the suicide deaths. The Air Force confirmed the data in the slide was accurate as of December the 31st, 2019. The Department of the Air Force has been and continues to pursue immediate, midterm, and long-range suicide prevention initiatives for the total force that focus on connections between individuals, units, and Air Force family, protections in environments, service, and policies, detection of risk in individuals and units, and equipping the total force and family members to mitigate risk and increase resilience. Lieutenant General Brian Kelly, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Manpower, Personnel, and Services, said in a statement, "Suicide is a difficult national problem without easily identifiable solutions that has the full attention of leadership." Goldfein, in a September interview with Air Force Magazine, said he wants a stand down to be the beginning of the conversations aimed at tackling the issue. For example, he pointed to online discussion forums that have popped up to help airmen through issues, and he pressed for first-line supervisors to spend more time with airmen to try and help if issues arise. We've got to figure out why, and then we've got to make sure that we build the environment out there where the right thing is easy and the wrong thing is hard and unacceptable, Goldfein said. The Veterans Crisis Hotline is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for veterans, service members, and their family members and friends who need help. Call 800-273-8255 and press 1, or text 838-255, or visit www.veteranscrisisline.net. And that's USAF suicide skyrocket in 2019. Margie?
Okay, Chuck, thank you very much. And this piece is entitled, "I'm Not the Same. Hurdles Remain for Troops and Veterans with TBI Despite Increase in Awareness." This is by Nikki Wendling, Stars and Stripes, published February 1st, 2020, Washington. Iraq War veteran Brian McGaw said he gets headaches a few times every week. They last from 20 minutes to 2 days, and in severity, on a 10-point pain scale, they go from a 4 to an 8. During his headaches, McGaw can't eat or be exposed to light. When they get too bad, he's forced to skip his college classes. McGaw, 44, also struggles with memory and concentration issues, making his schoolwork more difficult. He has post-traumatic stress disorder and is easily agitated. He has a traumatic brain injury caused when an IED blast sent shrapnel through the side of his skull, penetrating his brain. I think people should understand that the range of complications that come with traumatic brain injury are more than just headaches, McGaw said. Even mild cases can cause some severe issues early on. Memory and concentration issues, seizures, vision problems, anger issues. I'm not the same as I was. More than headaches. As of Thursday, more than 60 U.S. military personnel have been diagnosed with TBI from an Iranian missile attack January 8th in Iraq. That's far from President Donald Trump's initial announcement that no one was harmed in the attack. News of the brain injuries came out soon after, and the number of cases has continued to rise. Trump later described the injuries as, quote, headaches, and said he had seen far worse. Several veterans organizations are accusing Trump of minimizing the severity of TBI. It is a major cause of death and disability in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Defense Department, which keeps a tally of the total number of service members diagnosed with TBI, put the most recent count at nearly 414,000. It's now widely considered a signature wound of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Veterans of Foreign Wars was the first to urge Trump to apologize for his comments about TBI, calling his remarks misguided. The Jewish War Veterans of the United States, which has about 15,000 members, described Trump's comments as insensitive and counterproductive, and also asked that he apologize. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America asked for more than an apology. The group wants Trump to support a Senate bill that would establish a Department of Veterans Affairs Center of Excellence to focus on TBI research. Ryan Bridge, 29, who works with IAVA, was diagnosed with a mild TBI after a deployment to Afghanistan with the Vermont Army National Guard in 2009. He was on patrol when his unit was ambushed, and Bridge came within 10 meters of a mortar blast. Bridge experienced headaches, memory and concentration issues, and irritability, but it was 1 year before he was diagnosed by the VA. Though he doesn't think Trump's comments came from a place of ill will, Bridge worries his remarks about TBI have broader implications for those who suffer from it. I think as a country, we really need to improve our understanding of brain injury, reduce stigma, and encourage treatment, Bridge said. If you have someone as prominent as the president dismissing and denying that TBIs are legitimate injuries, people aren't going to take it seriously. To McGaw, Trump's comments were reminiscent of 2006 when he was diagnosed with TBI, when the injury wasn't widely understood even by medical professionals. McGaw's TBI is considered severe. He was in a bus headed back to his base in Iraq when an IED went off. Trump's remarks reminded me of back in the day when nobody really understood what it was and it was just kind of like suck it up and drive on, McGaw said. There's been a lot of improvement in how the medical field understands it, but not how people talk about it. Continuing pain. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters Thursday the full extent of the injuries from the January 8th missile attack might not be known for a year or two. In some cases, he said, troops would be monitored for the rest of their lives. And that's I'm not the same. Hurdles remain for troops, veterans with TBI, despite increase in awareness.
Thank you, Margie. My next item here, thoughtfully provided by Margie. Paul Farnes, last surviving ace of the Battle of Britain, dies at 101. And this is by Emily Langer from the Washington Post from the 30th of January. In England, they are known as the Few, the pilots who defended their country from Nazi aerial assault in the Battle of Britain during World War II. Among the few, whose ranks numbered approximately 3,000, Paul Farnes was one of the last surviving. And of those who remained, he was believed to be the only ace or aviator with the distinction of downing five or more enemy aircraft. Farnes was 101 when he died on January the 28th in West Sussex, England. His death was announced by the Battle of Britain Memorial Trust, which did not cite a cause. The trust credited him with a remarkable tally during the battle, a months-long aerial engagement that became the first significant German defeat in World War II. In total, he was said to have destroyed 6 enemy planes, probably destroyed another, and damaged 6 more. Farns, who attended the rank of wing commander in the Royal Air Force, described his exploits as just another day's work. He was born Paul Caswell Poe Farns in the English town of Boscombe on July the 16th, 1918. Because of the circumstances of his birth, he was considered illegitimate in the derogatory parlance of the time. He initially feared that the RAF might not accept him when he volunteered for service. His mother died the day after he was born. Farns recalled in an oral history published in the book Last of the Few, The Battle of Britain in the Words of the Pilots Who Won It, by military historian Max Arthur. My father said the midwife was to get rid of me and place him in a home for orphaned children, Farns recalled. But this lady took a fancy to me. She was just about 40 at the time, and she adopted me. I had a wonderful upbringing, just she and I together. By 1938, amid the looming threat of war, Farns decided to join the military. He planned to enlist in the Royal Navy, but was converted by an acquaintance. He recalled in an interview with the website History of War, "Why don't you fly?" The acquaintance asked him, "It's much more fun. You don't want to be in a ship." I'd agree with that. And so it was that Farns applied to join the RAF Volunteer Reserve in 1938. His adoptive mother wrote to the Air Ministry in his support and received the response that, "So long as your son can pass the necessary exams, medical and otherwise, we'd be glad to have him." Farns passed. On September the 1st, 1939, Hitler invaded Poland, marking the beginning of World War II. By then, Farns had already been called for active duty. He saw his first combat in the Battle of France, which began May 1940, and ended 6 weeks later with France's surrender. According to the Memorial Trust, his score during the Battle of France was 1 enemy aircraft destroyed, 1 possibly destroyed, and 2 shared. But that was just a curtain raiser to his impressive tally in the Battle of Britain, which began in July. Often described as the first major military battle waged entirely in the air, the engagement is considered a turning point in World War II because it helped stop the Germans from mounting an invasion of Britain. At the time, Farns was a sergeant flying fighter planes known as Hurricanes, which fought the German Luftwaffe in dogfights alongside Spitfires. "Suddenly you'd get a scramble and we'd be off," he told the BBC. "Sometimes you'd find the enemy, other times it was a wasted trip. It was really a bit chaotic. There were times, we know, when Hurricanes shot Spitfires down and Spitfires shot Hurricanes down. It was almost inevitable." He sometimes flew up to 5 sorties a day. On one of them, he was following a railway line in southern England when he encountered a German aircraft. "I thought, good God," so I whipped out and had to reposition myself and managed to get around behind him, Farns said in the History of War interview. "I gave him a couple of bursts and he crashed at Gatwick, just on the point between the airport and the racecourse. It was particularly poignant for me," Farns continued, "because I landed and the station commander took me over to meet the pilot of the German aircraft. I went to shake hands with him, but he wouldn't shake my hand. One of the gunners was all right, but the other was killed." Among fellow British pilots, he often recalled, it was difficult to make friends because any mission could prove fatal. The Battle of Britain resulted in more than 500 Allied deaths. The sobriquet, "The Few," came from a speech from British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who declared at the time, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." After the Battle of Britain, Farns was commissioned as an officer. He served in Malta, North Africa, and Iraq, ultimately retiring from the RAF in 1958. He later ran a hotel and became a celebrity among aviation enthusiasts at British air shows. A complete list of survivors was not immediately available. According to the best information available to the Memorial Trust, only 2 veterans of the Battle of Britain are still living, and neither was an ace. Farns sought to honor RAF ground crews whose care helped ensure the safety of pilots in the air, and he dismissed popular notions of his and other airmen's courage. "I don't go along with this business of people saying how brave we were," he once told the Daily Telegraph. It's a lot of nonsense. I don't think the average chap was brave at all. He was trained to do a job, and he did the job, and he did it well. If anything, Farns often said he rather relished his experience in the battle, which, besides turning back the Luftwaffe, allowed him to fly, just as he had set out to do. Everywhere in the Battle of Britain, we had marvelous airplanes, wonderful aircraft, and you flew several times a day, he said, and you were doing it for a reason, too. You were doing it to protect your country. Altogether, it was quite enjoyable. And that's Paul Farns, last surviving ace of the Battle of Britain, dies at 101.
Thank you, Chuck. That's a great story.
It is. I appreciate you bringing it in.
Well, I thought of you.
Not even close.
Okay, this next one is FDA expands access to ecstasy drug for PTSD therapy. This is by Nikki Wendling. Stars and Stripes, published January 21st, 2020, Washington. Iraq War veteran Jonathan Lubecki was deployed to Balad Air Base in 2006, where mortar attacks became part of daily life. During one enemy strike, Lubecki was knocked unconscious, suffering a traumatic brain injury. His overall combat experience resulted in post-traumatic stress disorder. After leaving the Army in 2009, he tried many treatments, including exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and several types of antidepressants. But nothing lessened his symptoms of PTSD. The pain became so overwhelming, Lubecki attempted suicide 5 times in 8 years. He said when he wasn't attempting to kill himself, he was thinking about it. In 2014, Lubecki tried something new. He volunteered for a clinical trial of MDMA, the illegal psychedelic drug commonly known as Molly, or ecstasy. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2017 designated MDMA as a breakthrough therapy to treat PTSD, and last week said it would allow more people to access the treatment. I already had 5 suicide attempts. I put a gun to my head 2 times and pulled the trigger, Lubecki said. I figured I was going to die anyway, that I might as well try ecstasy. And then it worked. Lubecki, a retired sergeant, took a dose of ecstasy and then was guided through 8 hours of intensive psychotherapy. He repeated the process 2 more times. The drug, which enhances feelings of empathy and euphoria while blocking the brain's ability to process fear, broke down the barriers that previously prevented Lubecki from opening up to therapists, he said. During those 24 hours of therapy, he talked about all of his traumas, his combat experience, divorce, and multiple suicide attempts, among other things. After the first session, Lubecki said he had fewer suicidal thoughts. He eventually went 1 full day without thinking of killing himself, then 2. 5 years after he completed the clinical trial, Lubecki no longer meets the qualifications for a PTSD diagnosis. The MDMA puts the mind, body, and spirit in a place it needs to be in order to heal, he said. It's like doing therapy while being hugged by everyone who loves you in a bathtub full of puppies licking your face. That's the best way I've been able to describe it. The study is sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, a nonprofit that formed in 1986 to fund research of the drug after MDMA was made illegal. The group announced Friday that MDMA-assisted psychotherapy will soon be available to more people. The FDA granted expanded access for the treatment, meaning patients outside of the clinical trials will be able to receive it. Also known as compassionate use, expanded access allows people facing a serious or life-threatening condition to undergo experimental therapies that could help them. In this case, the treatment will be made available to an additional 50 people at 10 sites across the country. The sites will be announced in the next few months. MAPS has already received 120 applications from sites that want to offer the treatment. At the same time, MAPS stands up the Expanded Access Program. It's continuing with phase 3 of the clinical trials at 15 sites in the United States, Canada, and Israel. The trials are expected to be completed in 2021, and the FDA could approve the treatment in 2022. The study has so far shown positive results. A phase 2 trial near Charleston, South Carolina, of which Lubecki was part, resulted in 68% of participants no longer showing PTSD symptoms after their second session. Of the 26 participants in that study, 22 were veterans. The veteran population experiences PTSD at a higher rate than the rest of the population. The VA estimates between 11 and 20% of veterans who served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have PTSD, compared with about 7 to 8% of the general U.S. population. No longer experiencing PTSD symptoms, Lubecki dedicates his time to advocating for the treatment, getting more veterans involved, and changing the way society talks about mental illness. He works for MAPS as a Veterans and Government Affairs liaison and often speaks about his experience with the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. Instead of a lifelong illness, he wants people to think of PTSD as a mental injury that can be healed. We've all been told this is a chronic, lifelong mental illness, that our symptoms can be addressed, but we can't make it go away, Lubecki said. MAPS and this MDMA therapy have shown that we can heal it. If he hadn't participated in the trial, Lubecki believes he would have died by suicide. I'd be in Arlington Cemetery, he said. The biggest impact on this has been my stepson. It's the reason he has a father instead of a folded flag. Anyone interested in applying for expanded access to MDMA therapy can learn more at mapspublicbenefit.com. That's mapspublicbenefit.com. And that was FDA expands access to ecstasy drug for PTSD therapy. Chuck?
Margie, my next item was originally from the Stars and Stripes, 4th of February, by Chad Garland, reported in military.com. 14 years after he was wounded in a blast, Iraq veteran gets a Purple Heart for his TBI. Combat medic David Ott's injury, caused by a roadside explosion in Iraq in 2006, seemed minor until months afterward he fell into a coma, his brain bleeding and swollen from the traumatic brain injury he'd suffered. 14 years later, the Iraq War veteran had a Purple Heart pinned to his chest for TBI so severe it left him with memory issues and in need of a service animal. I'm happy, and it finally brings closure to something that's been a long time coming, Ott told local news outlets. And kind of sad, too, because this is the last time that I'll be getting an award from the military. Ott was finally presented the medal, considered the military's oldest still in use, at a ceremony last week during the Old Warriors Luncheon at VFW Post 477 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where he now lives. Carlisle Barracks Command Sergeant Major Michael J. Carden presented the medal as TBI was again in the headlines out of Iraq, after at least 64 U.S. troops were diagnosed with brain injuries from an Iranian ballistic missile strike on Al-Asad Air Base last month. Critics said President Donald Trump minimized the wound's seriousness when he told reporters they weren't as bad as other traumatic blast injuries he'd seen, such as limb amputations. Considered one of the signature wounds of recent wars, TBI has long qualified for the Purple Heart, but in 2011, the Defense Department clarified the award criteria for cases where invisible wounds received during hostilities don't cause loss of consciousness and may not show immediate symptoms requiring treatment, as happened with Ott. Initially, Ott only felt dizzy and nauseated, he told Stars and Stripes. Though he suffered night terrors and headaches, he remained in Iraq and finished his tour. 2 months after returning home, he was on a trip to Disney World with his family in August 2006 when he went stiff as a board and dropped to the ground. He was medically evacuated to an Orlando hospital and spent nearly 6 weeks in a coma. The retired soldier, who also served as an Allentown police officer, suffered memory difficulties and still takes anti-seizure medication. For balance, he needs the help of his service dog, a black Labrador retriever named Sarge. He had initially put in for the Purple Heart by his unit. But it was denied, and the unit didn't pursue it further, Ott said. His childhood friend, Keith Holdren, a retired major who served in the same Pennsylvania National Guard unit, picked up the ball and submitted the paperwork seeking the Purple Heart for him four times. The medal finally showed up, unceremoniously, in the mail last summer. But that didn't sit well with Ott's wife, who emailed Rick Olson, the VFW post commander in Carlisle, to tell him it came with no paperwork, just a medal, nothing describing why it was awarded or why it had taken so long, Olson said. You don't need accolades, but sometimes it's nice to have the feeling that somebody else knows you did good, Jeannie Ott told the local Fox affiliate. Olson involved Carlisle Barracks and got Representative Scott Perry's office to help obtain the citation for the award. He then scheduled it to be presented during a lunch the post hosts every 2 months for World War II and Korean War veterans from six local retirement homes, he said. Local junior ROTC cadets were also among about 50 people in attendance. During the event, Holdren made sure that Ott also received a saber inscribed with his name and rank, an honor the former staff sergeant did not receive when he retired in early 2007 after more than 23 years of active duty and National Guard service. Not only does this sword help him move forward, but the Purple Heart finishes that journey, Jeannie Ott said. And that was 14 years after he was wounded in a blast, Iraq veteran gets a Purple Heart for his TBI. Margie?
Thank you, Chuck. This piece is Veterans Group, Lawsuit Prompts Pentagon to Reopen Database. This is by Ben Finley, Associated Press, published January 24th, 2020. Norfolk, Virginia. The Pentagon will reopen a records database that helps service members who are appealing a less than honorable discharge, a veterans group said Friday. The National Veterans Legal Services Program had sued the Defense Department over a lack of access to the database, arguing that the military had been breaking federal law since April. The database contains decisions by military review boards that grant or deny a veteran's request to upgrade a discharge. Veterans and their lawyers study those decisions in hopes of building successful arguments of their own. They can make a stronger case by looking to see how other people have won, said Bart Stickman, executive director of the organization that filed the lawsuit. Stickman said the Pentagon has agreed to make almost all of the records available by the end of March. But he said the quality of veterans' appeals likely suffered during the last several months. Appeals are being made at a time of growing recognition that a less than honorable discharge can stem from behaviors brought on by post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injuries. Liberal consideration is supposed to be given to veterans with combat-related mental health conditions and to those who were sexually assaulted while in the military. Veterans can lose some or all of the benefits that are available to them depending on their discharge status. Lisa Lawrence, a spokeswoman for the Defense Department, deferred comment about the lawsuit to the Department of Justice. Christina Mastropasqua, a DOJ spokeswoman, declined to comment. The Military Times first reported the change Wednesday. In a recent court filing, the veterans group said it has withdrawn a motion asking a federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, to take action. The group said the Pentagon's lawyers had propose certain actions that would resolve the concerns. In the meantime, the group's lawsuit has drawn the attention of 11 Democratic U.S. senators. They wrote a letter to military leaders Tuesday asking when the records would become available again. These decisions are of critical importance to veterans who received less than honorable or otherwise stigmatizing discharge characterizations from the military and who seek to upgrade or correct that characterization, the letter said. Dana Montalto, a clinical instructor at Harvard Law School's Veterans Legal Clinic, told the Associated Press earlier this month that post-9/11 vets have the highest rate of receiving less than honorable discharges. She added some veterans can wait years to get a decision from a military review board. The veterans group said its lawsuit will remain pending to ensure that all military board decisions are made available. The law firm, Hunton Andrews Kurth, has provided pro bono legal counsel to the group. And that is veterans group lawsuit prompts Pentagon to reopen database.
Just a reminder, you are listening to Weekly Reveille with Margie Earhart and Chuck Kaufman on the Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona, providing information access since 1979. You can listen to live streaming at sunsounds.org. My next item, from the McClatchy, Washington Bureau, Tara Kopp, and reported in military.com. Toxic black goo base used by U.S. had enriched uranium. More veterans report cancer. From Washington, for the last 6 weeks, a private Facebook group set up to help veterans who served at a toxic base in Uzbekistan has been flooded with new members, many with hauntingly familiar stories. I served at K2. I have cancer. It was overwhelming, said retired Army Chief Warrant Officer Scott Welch, a Special Operations Military Intelligence Officer who deployed to K2 or Karshin Kahanabad, Uzbekistan, in October 2001. McClatchy exclusively reported in December that the Pentagon had known from the beginning that K2, a former Soviet and Uzbek base, was contaminated with radioactive processed uranium, chemical weapons remnants, and underground pools of fuel and solvents that broke through the soil in a black goo. Despite contamination, about 7,000 U.S. forces were deployed there after the 9/11 attacks, from October 2001 to 2005, until Uzbekistan withdrew permission for the United States to use the base. After the K2 story became public, the Veterans K2 Facebook site was flooded with new requests to join. Each new member was vetted for their military service. Once accepted, more names of ill veterans began to surface. As the news stories came in, Welch volunteered to track the reported illnesses, but he had to step away. I was in bad shape from reporting all these medical issues, said Welch, who was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2014. By the end of January, the group had recorded 310 cancers. The last government count done by the Army in 2015 was that 61 service members who had been at K2 were diagnosed with cancer. That study was prompted by a number of U.S. Army Special Operations Command forces at K2 who had developed various types of cancer. Despite the Army Special Operations Command requesting the review, Special Operations Forces personnel could not be identified because of the classified nature of their mission, so those illnesses likely were not included in the 2015 count, the Army said at the time. The self-reported 310 cancers from the K2 veterans group, if accurate, means the number of cancer-stricken K2 veterans is now 5 times greater than the Army reported. Some of those K2 veterans will be in Washington this week looking for help from Congress. I've been wondering all of these years, how many more, said Kim Brooks, widow of Army Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Brooks. Timothy Brooks was one of the first to deploy to K2 and one of the first K2 veterans to die of cancer. The first signs came in 2002. That spring, Timothy Brooks and his wife were standing in their Fort Drum, New York kitchen, and he was agitated, she recalled, in a phone interview with McClatchy. Timothy Brooks had just left a meeting on base where he and other soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division had been handed a form to sign. The unit had just returned home from K2. They told us we were exposed to some really bad stuff, Brooks recalled her husband saying. Over the next few months, her husband's health deteriorated. He began to suffer terrible headaches and his temper changed, Kim Brooks said. The 6'5 athlete was constantly exhausted, but the family still prepared for him to deploy to Iraq with other elements of the 10th Mountain Division in spring of 2003. In new documents obtained by McClatchy, two classified maps and a PowerPoint highlight that base leadership had identified enriched uranium contamination in the northwest corner of the base, adjacent to where K2 forces worked and lived. Still, the official guidance on the contamination reported in an October 2001 to November 2001 classified environmental survey also obtained by McClatchy that the risk was that the risk of radiation was low. If the soldiers remain inside the confines of a large protective dirt berm, conduct radiological air monitoring for uranium, soluble and insoluble, in or near fighting positions nearest to the former missile storage site that classified environmental guidance advised. This week, K2 veterans and surviving spouses are in Washington to talk to members of Congress and press for a hearing about the toxic contamination on the base. They also plan to advocate for K2 veterans still struggling to get the Department of Veterans Affairs to recognize their illnesses as connected to their time in Uzbekistan. "We need to get in front of this. It's been killing us for 20 years now," said former Air Force Staff Sergeant Derek Blumke, who deployed to K2 in 2001 and in 2003 with the 16th Special Operations Wing. The VA has previously maintained that K2 veterans do not have a higher incident rate for cancer. However, once the agency was informed by McClatchy of the new numbers the veterans group is reporting, they provided an additional response. According to the latest reviews, there's no indication of increased cancer rates among veterans who served at Karshi Khanabad, said VA spokeswoman Susan Carter. "The limitations of self-reported surveys are well documented in the medical research community, but VA will work with the Department of Defense to study this issue further as new empirical data becomes available." In January, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform's National Security Subcommittee sent letters to the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, and VA Secretary, Robert Wilkie, requesting the agencies turn over, by January 24th, any documents that describe the conditions of K2 and what has been done to treat the veterans who serve there. Neither department has responded, a committee aide said, on the condition they not be identified. In May 2003, Timothy and Kim Brooks were in Fort Drum's gym listening to a colonel address soldiers and their families in a pre-deployment ceremony. Their unit would depart in a week. Timothy Brooks put his head in his hands. "I don't feel well," Brooks said. "We got to walk out." Outside the gym door, Timothy Brooks collapsed to the ground and turned gray. Kim Brooks ran back into the gym. "I threw open the doors because the medics were all in a line there with their kits, and I screamed, 'I need a medic now. Come help my husband,'" Brooks said, her voice breaking. Timothy Brooks was diagnosed with stage 3 brain cancer. He died a year later on May 29, 2004. He was 36. Because Timothy Brooks was on active duty when he was diagnosed and when he died, Kim Brooks and her 4 children have received financial and education benefits from the military and VA. But not all K2 families have had the same experience. Veterans who were not on active duty when the cancer was diagnosed face a much harder path to receive a determination that the illness was connected to their time in service so they can get benefits. Kim Brooks said she will be in Washington for them. "If they were there and they're sick, our country needs to take care of them. Bottom line," said Brooks. Welch feels the same way. "In the beginning, before I found this group, my ideal outcome was strictly personal," Welch said. "I wanted benefits for me. Now it's a much bigger picture." This article was written by Tara Koop from Special to McClatchy, Washington Bureau, and appeared in military.com. "Toxic black goo base used by U.S. had enriched uranium." Margie?
Okay, Chuck. Thank you. That was a
awful,
difficult story. But now we have our dog story.
Thank goodness.
I know. And this is entitled, it's part dog story. Dog in person story. It's called "I Have a Sense of Purpose: How Service Dogs Help Veterans Cope with PTSD." And this is by Steve Bannon, Stars and Stripes, published January 29th, 2020. Washington, Damien Jungerman knows what it's like to experience severely dark moments after multiple combat tours overseas. But he said Shay, a mixed-breed plot hound, has been a critical part of his recovery from post-traumatic stress disorder since they met last year. When I returned from Afghanistan, I was diagnosed with PTSD and traumatic brain injuries. I wanted to stay in my apartment away from everyone. But now with Shay, I'm engaging in the world more. I'm going to the park and sleeping better. Shay has given me a quality of life that I had lost. Jungerman, 45, was a naval explosive ordnance disposal technician and served three deployments to Afghanistan, sometimes working with special operations units such as SEAL teams, Team 3 and 5, and the 3rd and 7th Special Forces groups. EOD troops are responsible for disarming and safely removing improvised explosive devices, which are responsible for the majority of combat deaths since 9/11. I had issues, but I didn't really know I had issues, he said. I had huge rage problems. I picked up a grocery cart and threw it and thought it was okay. I wasn't a drinker, but I was super impulsive. Jungerman, medically, retired from the military due to his PTSD and TBI as a chief petty officer. While he was still serving, he said he was initially afraid of seeking counseling because of the stigma that can come with it. A 2015 study from the Defense Department, the most recent data, found 35% of service members indicated that seeking mental health treatment is damaging to their military career, which makes it a top reason for not seeking care. However, there's little evidence backing those concerns. But Jungerman finally sought treatment after being implored to do so by a fellow veteran who also sought mental health care. There was an officer in my last platoon that did the same number of deployments I had and lost a few partners, and he acknowledged that he had some problems and started going to counseling. He told me I really had to go. The psychologist has been life-changing. During Jungerman's treatment, a friend recommended a service dog, touting the benefits they can provide veterans. He said it helped him sleep for the first time, and that was something I was having a hard time with, Jungerman said. Jungerman got Shay, now almost 2 years old, through Canines for Warriors, one of several groups that train and provide service dogs to veterans. According to a spokeswoman for the nonprofit, all the dogs are rescues and tend to be mixed breeds. However, they occasionally train purebred poodles or doodles for allergy-sensitive veterans. We always say that the dogs and warriors rescue each other, said Alana Dole, who works with Canines for Warriors, which has provided more than 600 dogs to veterans. There are literally thousands of perfect service dog candidates sitting in shelters across the country, hoping for a chance at a better life. Part of our mission is to rescue them, to give both the veteran and dog a new leash on life. Furthermore, our veterans are able to bond with shelter dogs more, knowing they both share a painful or trauma-filled past. Recent studies have found dogs can be a critical coping tool for veterans. A 2018 Purdue University study found veterans with service dogs produced significantly higher levels of cortisol, a hormone involved in processing stress. Having a service dog was also associated with less anger, less anxiety, and better sleep, said Carrie Rodriguez, the lead author of the research paper, noting dogs are still not the only solution to combating a mental health crisis. These findings present exciting initial data regarding the physiological response to living with a service dog. However, the study did not establish a direct correlation on an individual level between cortisol levels and levels of PTSD symptoms, and further study is needed. It is important to keep in mind that service dogs do not appear to be a cure for PTSD. Nonprofits are one of the only avenues for veterans to adopt service dogs. The Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't provide any funds for service or emotional support animals, but concluded a congressionally mandated study on the benefits of dogs for PTSD care in July. According to Christina Mandrucci, a spokeswoman for the department, the results of one part of the study on whether service or emotional support dogs can help veterans with PTSD is expected to be released in the summer, and the results on whether dogs can lead to overall health care savings with fewer hospital stays and less resilience on medication is expected by the end of the year. Canines for Warriors trains the dogs, and the veterans are responsible for the costs of raising the dogs after adoption. However, the nonprofit has emergency funds available for costly emergency veterinary care. The time between a veteran applying for a dog and finally bringing a four-legged friend home varies, but in Jungerman's case, the entire process took about 14 months, including a three-week training session in Pontevedra, Florida. Our warriors stay at our campus for 3 weeks, where we match them with their service dogs upon arrival, Dole said. The program allows the warriors to learn the commands, bond with their service dogs, and benefit from peer support from other warriors in their group. What helped Jungerman most was Shay gave him something to care about, and the dog helped him get out more. He said the two walked 10 miles every day. I also have to maintain his training. I have a sense of purpose, Jungerman said. I'm able to focus on him more than the other variables that would normally bother me. What he's done for me, I sleep better. I'm on almost no sleep meds whatsoever. Better attention span. Less irritability, and most of all, he gets me up and out of the apartment. Canines for Warriors recommends veterans suffering from PTSD investigate how to get a service dog. Most of our veterans tell us a service dog was the last resort, but it ends up being the only tool that helped them recover from PTSD and suicidal thoughts, Dole said. And that was I Have a Sense of Purpose, How Service Dogs Help Veterans Cope with PTSD.
Great story, Margie. Wonder why it takes so long to get connected with a dog, since the value seems to be so self-evident.
I know that it takes a long time to train these dogs.
Oh, yeah, the training aspect, but for somebody to have to wait, you know, that length of time, that...
Although 14 months, Chuck, seemed not so long to me. I know of people outside the veteran community who wait much longer than that.
Ah.
What a great service this is.
Yes, absolutely. My next item from military.com, VA Secretary Wilkie on firing his deputy. Nothing personal, just business. Richard Sisk writes for military.com on the 5th of February. VA Secretary Robert Wilkie said Wednesday that he fired Deputy Secretary James Byrne for failing to gel with the rest of the leadership team and stressed that the dismissal was not related to an alleged sexual assault case at the Washington, D.C. VA Medical Center. It was a simple business decision to sack Byrne, who had been the number two at the Department of Veterans Affairs for 5 months, Wilkie said, adding that there was nothing personal in the abrupt move to terminate him, effective immediately on Monday. Byrne left the Marine Reserves as a lieutenant colonel and previously had served as the VA's general counsel. It was in the best interests of the organization to remove him from his deputy secretary post, Wilkie said at a National Press Club news conference. Wilkie did not give any additional details on what made Byrne a poor fit for the team, but noted he wished him well and called him a man of great distinction. Wilkie also said it was categorically untrue that Byrne's firing was linked to the ongoing dispute over the claim of sexual assault filed by Navy Reserve Lieutenant Andrea Goldstein, a staffer on the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Goldstein had alleged that another veteran rubbed up against her and made lewd suggestions at the Washington, D.C. Medical Center last September. Byrne's name had surfaced in the case as he participated in conversations with VA Inspector General Michael Misal about it. Wilkie drew a rebuke from Missile when he described the case as unsubstantiated in a letter to California Representative Mark Takano. Reaching a decision to close the investigation with no criminal charges does not mean that the underlying allegation is unsubstantiated, Missal said. At the news conference, Wilkie stopped short of issuing an apology, but said he met with Missal Tuesday night to iron out differences. He also said he would be in contact with Takano on the Goldstein case to make sure her needs are taken care of. And that was VA Secretary Wilkie on firing his deputy. Nothing personal, just business. Margie?
Okay, Chuck, and this is a very local story from the Daily Courier, entitled Flags on Navajo Nation Lowered to Honor Deceased Code Talker, Window Rock. Flags on the Navajo Nation will be lowered Monday to honor a revered Navajo code talker who died in New Mexico last week. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez said in a statement that all flags will fly at half-staff as a tribute to Joe Vandeveer Sr. through Thursday. Vandeveer died Friday of health complications in Haystack, according to his family. He was 96. Vandeveer was among hundreds of Navajos who served in the U.S. Marine Corps during World War II, transmitting messages using a code based on the Navajo language. The code developed by an original group of 29 Navajos was used to confound Japanese forces. It was never broken. Vandeveer enlisted in the Marines in Santa Fe in March 1943 and was honorably discharged in January 1946. He worked multiple jobs after the war, including for an oil company and as a mining prospector, and stressed the importance of the Navajo language. He also was a medicine man. Vandeveer's death leaves less than a handful of Navajo code talkers still alive. A funeral service is scheduled for Wednesday, but a location is still being determined. He will be buried Thursday at the Santa Fe National Cemetery. And that was Flags on Navajo Nation, lowered to honor deceased code talker. Chuck?
My next item, does the VA care improve disabled veterans' health? More research needed, the GAO finds. This is from the 29th of January by Dorothy Mills Greggs of military.com. The Department of Veterans Affairs keeps limited research on how its care helps veterans with service-connected conditions recover, a government watchdog said in a report released this month. Representative Jack Bergman, Republican of Michigan, a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General, asked the Government Accountability Office to study whether VA care and benefits are helping veterans with service-connected disabilities get better. The subsequent GAO report found the results difficult to determine because of the data wasn't easily available to compare, and the majority of reevaluations of veterans' disability statuses did not change. Until VA develops and implements a plan to address challenges that have hindered analysis thus far and enhance collaboration between the Veterans Benefits Administration, or VBA, and the Veterans Health Administration, VHA, with regard to such analysis, the GAO staff wrote in the report. VA will not be positioned to understand the characteristics, needs, and health outcomes of veterans with service-connected conditions, which available research suggests may be different from other veterans. GAO staff found that less than 4% of reevaluations performed in fiscal years 2013 through 2018 resulted in an increase or decrease to the veterans' overall disability ratings, while about 95% of the cases stayed the same. Importantly, tracking and analyzing trends and outcomes could shed light on an apparent contradiction. Why the majority of recent reevaluations resulted in no change in veterans' combined ratings when regulations state that reevaluations generally should not be conducted in these cases, staff added in the report. As a result of its study, among the GAO's recommendations were to create a plan to integrate the data necessary to see how VA care is improving the health of veterans with a service-connected disability, and clarify its training for staff so service-related conditions excluded from reevaluation would be marked properly. Proper training would keep unnecessary reevaluations from causing a burden on veterans, according to the report. A VA Inspector General report from 2018 found the addition of lesser-trained veteran service representatives to the reevaluation process caused an estimated 15,500 unwarranted exams. The VA reported to Congress in 2018 that the Veterans Benefits Association, or Administration rather, had completed 19,000 reevaluations out of its 364,000 disability compensation rating claims. Less than 5% of these reevaluations were backlogged or waiting more than 4 months for completion. The VA agreed with two of the recommendations, saying it would develop a plan by this summer to make the data easier to compare. However, it disagreed with the recommendation to clarify staff training on reevaluating veterans' ratings. In a written response to the GAO report, VA staff said its 95% accuracy rating for claims confirms the VBA is giving its employees the skills and knowledge to successfully process these claims. The VBA agrees appropriately skilled and trained employees are necessary to complete all claims processing work, including the review of future routine examinations, the VA staff wrote. If refresher training is warranted for individuals, local quality review team members can provide focused training locally. That was VA Care. Does it improve disabled veterans' health? More research is needed, the GAO finds.
Thank you, Chuck. And I'd like to just say that you've been listening to Weekly Reveille, a production of Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading network. Tune in this time every week for Veterans News. Thank you for joining us. Good night.
Good night.